It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama will address the nation tonight about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The White House is pressing BP to put billions of dollars in an escrow fund to pay people affected. And we're joined this morning by the president's spokesman, Robert Gibbs. Mr. Gibbs, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Do you have an agreement with BP on a compensation fund?
Steve, I'd say we're working on that with a whole host of entities. The point of this is to create, if need be, through legal the legal authority we have, an independent entity to administer the claims process, to take it away from BP and to ensure that people are getting their claims filled quickly, efficiently, and transparently.
You said the legal authority you have. What authority do you have to force BP to hand over billions of dollars prior to losing some lawsuit?
Well, again, we have legal authorities under the laws as passed by the Congress to deal with disasters such as this, and the president intends to use those authorities to ensure that the claims process for those damaged economically in the Gulf is taken care of.
But do you have authority for the president to say to BP, its CEO Tony Hayward, give me money, give it now?
Absolutely. BP is the responsible party. They have to pay for the cleanup. They have to pay for the restoration of the environmental damage that they've done. And they've got to pay the economic claims for those in the Gulf region whose livelihoods have been damaged as a result of their mismanagement.
And they have to pay now, not later after a court proceeding.
No, they've got to pay now. They're on the hook just as millions in the Gulf are on the hook for money that they may owe on a boat, money that they're going to lose because they're not fishing, or a hotel worker or a hotel owner who's watching reservations for the summer be canceled.
And $20 billion, is that the figure you want from BP?
Well, I've seen a lot of different figures. I think the key is this. That figure, whatever that number is, has to pay all the claims. And whatever figure is put into an escrow account on the front end does not in any way limit the amount of damages that BP is responsible for. They'll have to make the citizens of the Gulf whole regardless of what that cost is.
Mr. Gibbs, the state treasurer of Louisiana is one of a number of public officials, some of them Democrats, who are warning that a fund like this could push BP into bankruptcy, which would be disastrous for people who are expecting BP to pay them. Can BP get away from you like that?
No, I don't think they can. Obviously, BP is a large, very wealthy company with lots of assets and lots of cash. What our focus is on is holding that large, very wealthy company responsible for the damages that it caused. The law states exactly what it has to pay for, and that's what the president will hold them accountable for.
Meaning you're not worried about bankruptcy here?
I think if you look at the quarterly statements going back the last several quarters, how much money BP has made in profit, billions and billions of dollars, I think there's no doubt that they have not just the legal responsibility, but the financial wherewithal to make people whole, absolutely.
We're talking with Robert Gibbs, presidential spokesman here on Morning Edition. And Mr. Gibbs, I want to ask a little bit about the cleanup along the shores of the Gulf of Mexico. Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat, as you know, from Florida, said this the other day. This is a quote, "The information is not flowing, the decisions are not timely, the resources are not produced, and as a result, you have a big mess." Is he right about that?
Well, there's no doubt that we have a big mess. We have hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico heading towards different parts of the shores. I don't think, though, that I would agree with his overall characterization. There are tens of thousands of people in the Gulf working. There are thousands of boats and vessels that have been on the water literally for 57 days, for the entirety of this disaster, skimming oil, burning oil, removing oil, trying to plug the leak 5,000 feet below the surface of the ocean, and doing all and anything that we can when oil comes ashore to clean it up.
Very briefly, though, there have been lots of stories of boats just sitting around, even people being paid for sitting around with no instructions getting to them.
Well, I don't think that in any way represents the majority of what's happening. There's, again, thousands and thousands of vessels that are on the water. States that have hired fishermen that are now out of work because they can't fish in the Gulf, attach skimming equipment to their boats in order to sweep up oil that has leaked into the Gulf, and not allowing it to get to sensitive environmental areas.
Okay, Robert Gibbs, thanks very much. He's a presidential spokesman.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The town of West Baden Springs in southern Indiana is home to a hotel so grand and magnificent, it was once called the Eighth Wonder of the World. Next door in the town of French Lick are mineral springs whose waters are said to cure just about any ailment. The resort towns once drew presidents, movie stars, and mobsters, most famously Al Capone. Well, more recently, they caught the attention of crime writer Michael Corita. The Indiana native has made the town's and the newly restored West Baden Springs Hotel the setting for his latest novel, a supernatural thriller called So Cold the River. I asked Michael Corita to talk about his inspirations for the book and to give us a synopsis of the story without giving too much away.
The story involves a down-on-his-luck, self-inflicted down-on-his-luck filmmaker named Eric Shaw, who was at one point in time a rising cinematographer in Hollywood. And his career has bottomed out, and he's now making what he calls video life portraits, tributes for memorial services, essentially. And he finds his way down to these towns of West Baden and French Lick to record the history of a dying man who left very few clues behind about his childhood, just the name of the town. And he has one bottle that he's carried with him for his entire life that is a Pluto water bottle. Pluto water was the substance bottled in the French Lick area around the turn of the century that was reputed to cure basically any affliction known to man.
And Pluto water is not something that you made up. I mean, there really was.
No, unfortunately.
A product called Pluto water.
All of the really great stuff in this novel I stole from reality. I'd love to claim that I have that sort of imagination, but the history was there, so I just borrowed it.
Do you remember the first time you saw the hotel, and what state was it in when you first saw it?
I remember it very vividly, actually. I think I was about 8 years old, and at that point, it was in a state of total decay. My father's an electrical engineer. He's always been interested in architecture, and he took my sister and I down there with my mother to see the place. And it stands out as a very vivid memory because even in that state of disrepair, you could sense the grandeur that had been there once. And with that arose this question of why had it ever been here? And then why did it disappear? And from that point on, I was very interested in the history. I tried for a while to work that setting and that history into a traditional crime novel plot. That's what I'd written through five books. And it just never worked. Everything was always returning to like a casino heist novel, which I did not want to write. And it was when I finally committed to the idea of taking it in a very new direction and going toward the supernatural that I finally felt I had a story that gelled with, you know, the rich fabric of the place.
I want to ask you about how you work, if I can. I understand that you create almost like a soundtrack for each of your projects. And in
right.
this book in particular, you were influenced in some way by the music of another son of Indiana, Joshua Bell, the violinist,
right.
and
yes.
a particular work called the
Short Trip Home.
Mm-hmm. Why that piece and how did it influence you?
The song itself is just scorchingly beautiful. It's an incredible piece of music. He worked on that with Edgar Meyer, who's another Indiana University graduate. Mm-hmm. And it's an Americana folk-inspired piece. But there's this joined quality of beauty and sorrow. And something about that, it's just a haunting song. He hits notes that still just put chills down my spine. I became kind of obsessed with the idea that I wanted to imagine a story behind the song. And I fixated on the image of a Depression-era prodigy playing in tattered clothing and with his case open for coins. Originally, I had viewed that image as kind of a standalone moment. Eric Shaw, my protagonist, begins to have visions when he arrives in these towns, and it occurred to me that having just, you know, floating set-piece visions wasn't going to accomplish much. They needed to work in a narrative of their own, and I knew I needed the past and the present to collide. And so I began to think more about the boy and what his story would be. And his song turned into an elegy then for lost parents. And once I discovered that he had lost his family, I thought, okay, well, who is he living with now? How did he end up in this place? And so all these questions continued to arise from the song itself.
Michael, before I let you go, I have to ask, what do the current owners of the West Baden Springs Hotel and Resort think of this book? Have you let them take a look at this?
Yeah,
I can't imagine that it's exactly good for business.
Well, actually, we're hoping just the opposite, and I think they're taking it with great enthusiasm. I wanted to be sure that I wasn't writing a haunted hotel story. You know, it's more about the water and the towns themselves. You know, hopefully it will intrigue some people. So,
Michael Corita, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Corita, his latest book is So Cold the River. A question for you. What's the most suspenseful novel you've ever read? We're taking nominations at the Summer Book section of our website, npr.org.
Rolling out the new health care overhaul law is proving almost as tricky as getting it passed. Democrats now face criticism for whatever happens in health care, as NPR's Julie Robner reports.
Bit by bit, the Obama administration is making the critical decisions, fleshing out parts of the law that legislators left undefined. Yesterday, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius announced the rules to determine which health plans can remain as is when the new system goes fully into effect in 2014.
As we designed the new law, we knew that a lot of Americans actually like their current insurance plans. They want more choices, but they want one of those choices to be the plan they have.
Under the rules, companies can keep their plans unchanged, be grandfathered in, if they don't raise premiums too much or cut benefits substantially. The idea, said Sebelius, was to strike a balance.
These rules are carefully written to make sure the grandfathered plans still have the flexibility they need to make reasonable changes, but also making sure that insurance companies don't use this additional flexibility to take advantage of their customers.
Republicans, however, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, were quick to pounce on the fact that HHS's own estimates show that many health plans, particularly those serving small businesses, won't qualify.
The government is about to change the plans most Americans have. Here's one more promise the administration has broken on health care and one more warning Republicans issued on this bill that's been vindicated.
What Republicans don't say is that plans that do have to change will have to offer more, not less, benefits and consumer protections. Things like free preventive services and guaranteed direct access to obstetrician gynecologists for women. But most of that's not going to affect people for another 3 years. Where Democrats are more immediately vulnerable is what's going to happen to people's health insurance next year.
I think you can expect to continue to see significant increases in what you pay for your health care.
Mike Thompson is with the consulting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers. He's just completed a study of how employers plan to cope with medical inflation next year, which is expected to be about 9%.
There's been a dramatic change over the last few years in terms of employers moving their plan designs to have much higher deductibles and higher coinsurance in network.
In other words, employers are passing many of the increased costs back to workers. Rather than paying $20 for an office visit, more plans are calling for a 20% share of the bill. And Thompson says next year, a majority of workers will have deductibles higher than $400 for in-network care. Now, next year's higher costs don't stem from the new law, and none of the cost-constraining elements of the new law have taken effect yet. But those are niceties likely to be lost on most of the public, says health policy analyst Bob Leshefsky.
The Democrats have guaranteed that the American health care system is going to be affordable. They put it in the title of their bill. So everything that happens after March 23, 2010, is theirs. They own it.
That was the date President Obama signed the bill into law. In fact, Leshefsky says, for the next few years at least, many of the things the law calls for, like major investments in electronic medical records, will at least temporarily boost spending.
There's no chance we're going to have affordable health insurance in this country in the next few years at least.
Meaning the political fight over health care is a long way from being over. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And you hear Julie on Morning Edition from NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Deborah Amos, in for Renee Montaigne. Oil from the BP well is washing ashore in four states. President Obama is setting foot in three of them during a two-day trip. And tonight, the oil spill disaster will be the subject of his first-ever primetime Oval Office speech.
This is all part of an effort to show that the White House is on top of the crisis. In a moment, we'll hear about the administration's call for BP to set up a compensation fund. This would be a fund for people who've taken a financial hit from the oil spill. We begin with NPR's Ari Shapiro, who's traveling with the president.
When Air Force One touched down in Mississippi, Governor Haley Barbour was there to greet the president. Now, Barbour often says the biggest problem facing his coastline right now is not oil, it's fear of oil. Tourists have stopped coming to the beaches. That has not been Mr. Obama's message, but yesterday, Barbour nodded vigorously when the president said this.
If people want to know what can they do to help folks down here, one of the best ways to help is to come down here and enjoy the outstanding hospitality.
After meeting with local officials at the Coast Guard station in Gulfport, Governor Barbour and President Obama met local business owners for lunch on the beach. The absence of tourists was evident. They ate on an empty dock surrounded by empty beach in the sweltering heat. A snow cone shack nearby made plenty of sales, but that was mostly to the president's entourage. There was no sign of oil, but that changed once the president crossed the border. We're here in Theodore, Alabama, where workers in yellow rubber suits are using high-pressure water to clean oil-soaked boom. The president is taking a tour of this staging facility. Boom is being brought in, cleaned, redeployed, and here he comes. The heat index was near 110. With all their heavy gear, workers need to take a 20-minute rest for every 30 minutes of work. In another part of the staging facility, Stephen Martin sticks a bright yellow vinyl patch over a punctured stretch of neon orange boom that's been brought in from the Gulf.
And what we're doing is we've glued it to the boom to repair a hole in it, and we're also heating it up to the point of fusing the two materials together to form a water and airtight patch.
He's working with Matt Alexander.
I don't think the manufacturers aren't manufacturing it fast enough, so they're trying to repair everything that comes in from the Gulf that's damaged instead of putting new boom, we're repairing old.
This facility repairs 10,000 feet of boom a day. BP contracted the company that hires these workers. When Mr. Obama finished his tour, he spoke to reporters, and he described the spill as though it were a war.
It's an ongoing assault whose movements are constantly changing. That's what makes this crisis so challenging.
He promised success.
Things are going to return to normal. This region that's known a lot of hardship will bounce back just like it's bounced back before.
But that day may be far off, and there are many challenges between now and then. One that came up in the speech was food safety.
I'm announcing a comprehensive, coordinated, and multi-agency initiative to ensure that seafood from the Gulf of Mexico is safe to eat.
Mr. Obama made a point of eating local seafood on this trip, twice over the course of the day. His last stop in Alabama was at a restaurant called Tacky Jack's. The atmosphere was festive, and the view was gorgeous from the third-floor deck overlooking the water. The back story is not as happy. People often pull up to Tacky Jack's in their boats, but last week that practice ended when oil came in on the high tide and officials closed the inshore waterway. The restaurant's famous for its local seafood, but this week the oysters were from Texas. The presidential motorcade left Orange Beach, Alabama for Pensacola, Florida. Tommy and Lori Smith stood on the side of the road with a sign.
We'll read it. What it says is, Obama, would you allow a three-month spill on your coastline? We really believe that he's not doing everything necessary to get this fixed. We're out here every day, and today I have not seen a single BP worker on the beach the entire day. And they said they've got thousands out, but where are they? If he was up at his home in Hawaii, this would not come on shore.
President Obama is trying hard to change their minds. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Pensacola.
High school graduation is a certainty for some students and a long shot for others. For 10 Philadelphia students graduating from high school tonight, the event was far from guaranteed. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
The students at graduation rehearsal are going through the same steps as seniors at other schools. One by one, members of the first graduating class of Arise Academy practice walking slowly in a line.
Look at the person in front of you and try to stay in step with the person in front of you. Arms by your side, please.
Standing in front of a row of folding chairs, they look like any other group of graduates. Some of the girls have clearly spent a lot of time fine-tuning their outfits and hair. Traheed Walker is one of 140 students at Arise, the nation's only charter high school designed specifically to serve children in foster care.
Ever since I was little, I've been in and out of shelters and in and out of schools, truancy and all that. And that was another reason why my grades were so bad, because I barely was in school, because we kept moving from place to place.
Walker credits Arise with helping turn his life around and putting him on track to go to college, something he once had no intention of doing. Class valedictorian Diane Pugh says Arise is very different from other schools.
A lot of my other friends thought that mentioning that they were in foster care to their other friends was a big deal, because a lot of kids would treat them differently, and a lot of people think that foster, it's like a stereotype that foster kids are bad, crazy, they're poor.
Arise solves one other problem for Philadelphia foster kids, too. In the past, as students have changed foster homes, they've often changed schools. Not so at Arise Academy. Students can continue to go to school here, even if they change home placements. That's critical, because moving around to different schools can make it tough for foster kids to succeed academically. Arise Academy is funded by the School District of Philadelphia. The school has also received private donations and other money from the federal government. Diane Pugh says this school really is tailored to helping its students.
It's more flexibility, more attentiveness from teachers, and you get more one-on-one time. And a lot of people just are truly here to help you. And the learning here is good, especially if you're in a different level, because people who go through foster care may not be on the same level as the next person.
Pugh says the school's employees work with students to fill in the gaps in their education.
It's like I have 10 of my own children.
Guidance counselor Jackie Moscovici has helped the Arise graduates get to this point.
I do every grant, scholarship, any type of financial aid, all college applications, college admissions, college searches, major searches. So everything that a parent may do, I have to do it in my position. So it's really, it's taking the guidance counselor position and being a guidance counselor and a parent and a mentor and a friend.
The audience at tonight's graduation will reflect the complex web that surrounds the graduates. There will be cheering school employees, and class valedictorian Diane Pugh says a lot of people who have encouraged her over the years will be at her graduation. Even her therapist wants to come. Traheed Walker expects a full crowd, including his mom, aunt, sisters, and foster mom, all there to watch him cross the stage. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in Philadelphia.
And we end this hour by eating some crow. Yesterday, I spoke with LA Times reporter Kevin Baxter about the controversial jabalani, the official ball of the 2010 World Cup. Players are complaining that this particular kind of soccer ball is unpredictable and is affecting play. Well, in that conversation, I referred to goalie Robert Green as the British goalkeeper, and that sparked an angry email from a listener who reminded us that, quote, it is the English soccer team, not the British soccer team. In fact, that email came from our executive producer, Christopher Turpin, who, as an Englishman and a football fanatic, took particular offense. And Chris, you're here to read me the riot act, right?
Yes, Melissa, six of the best for you. I can't believe you're usually such a stickler for these kind of things. I just can't believe you got this one wrong. As you should know, Britain is composed of England, Wales, and Scotland. Throw in Northern Ireland, and you have the United Kingdom. All of those countries compete internationally, individually in soccer. So there's an England team, a Scotland team, there's a Welsh team and a Northern Irish team. As an Englishman, I have a little frisson of nationalistic pride that the English were the only of the British teams that actually qualified for the 2010 World Cup. It's why you see English fans carrying a white flag with a red cross, not the Union Jack. It's the English flag. It's the Cross of St. George, part of which makes up the Union Jack.
Well, let's think ahead, Chris. Friday, you have England, not Britain, England playing Algeria in the World Cup. If I were to go to, say, Scotland, to a bar, which sounds great, who would they be rooting for in that bar?
Well, I've actually been in a bar in Scotland during an England game, and I can tell you there were not many people there rooting for England. I think you'll find that some of the most rowdy Algerian fans will be sitting in the bars of Scotland. There are lots of Brits who love to root against England during the World Cup and at any other sporting events.
Chris, thanks for setting us straight, as you always do, on all things British.
Happy to do so.
That's our executive producer and resident Brit, or Englishman, Christopher Turpin. and you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.